we continue to think how this affects the life of the church then and the life of the church today. Luke was very careful about selecting the stories. He must have had a wealth of information. And he includes this one, the story about the conversation which happened with the with Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. The disciples in those days were having to come to terms with the fact that Jesus was risen, was present with them, though they didn't always see him. But the faith continued to grow and to develop in ways that they hadn't appreciated before. And there were lots of converts, very different people, and the disciples, the apostles, began to feel that they were overwhelmed with all the problems that were occurring, because they were not all known welcoming Jews that were becoming part of the church, but there were Gentiles being attracted to it. There were people from other countries. And so they decided that they would, in order to spread the load a bit, they would appoint seven deacons who were Greek-speaking so that they could speak more readily to other peoples who were coming to faith. One of the deacons that was appointed was Stephen. And it wasn't long, as you remember from your reading of the Acts, that Stephen was stoned to death. And a man called Saul was standing by, watching as they did it, and then continuing the work of making sure that this faith couldn't go very far, of persecuting Christians. And the persecution in Jerusalem was so strong that Philip, another of the deacons, went off to Samaria, an area that you wouldn't think of as being one of the places to be evangelized by a new Christian faith. But Samaria, he did so well in Samaria, and many people were converted. And then Luke tells us that Philip found himself on a wilderness road going down from Jerusalem to Gaza. Doesn't that send a sort of shiver down our spine? Here was Philip finding himself on the road from Jerusalem to Gaza, where he met up with an Ethiopian eunuch, a dark-skinned man going back to work in the area of Ethiopia, where he was in charge of the whole treasury of the queen. Well, sometimes the title eunuch was given as a sort of title to include officials. But more likely, he was a castrated male, a man who had given his life to serving the palace of the queen, and therefore had given up all thought of having a home and family of his own. And this is what happened. He was well-trusted, high-ranking official in an honorable nation. And he had been to Jerusalem to worship, where, of course, he would not be allowed into the temple. But he somehow had picked up there a scroll of Isaiah, and he was reading it in his chariot as he went home. And Philip caught up with him and ran alongside him, this man in his fancy chariot with his horses, who invited Philip to join him and asked him questions about this scroll. Who's he talking about when he talks about humiliation and being cast off? And Philip is able to tell him the stories of Jesus, who was a Jew who died to save the world. How can we imagine that conversation that went on between these two men? And then they came to some water, water in the desert. And the Ethiopian says to Philip, "What is to prevent me from being baptized?" Well, my goodness, what a loaded question. All sorts of things, all sorts of objections might have been brought up. But Philip, in that moment of time, thinks there is nothing on earth that could prevent this man being baptized into this new faith. And so he baptizes him. And the Ethiopian goes on his way rejoicing. And Philip, we're told, goes on the road north towards Caesarea, which other sources, though the Bible doesn't tell us, other sources say, Philip settled down, married, and had four daughters. These are the stories of events that took place, which were significant for the time. But it was a critical moment for the church as to how they were to develop, whether it was going to be a sect within Judaism and Judea, whether it was contained within those who had previously known of God, or whether it was actually going to spread and become a different kind of religious faith that would move through many different places. And they had to consider this carefully. And we know that although Philip had gone ahead and baptized this man, they then had all sorts of debates in the church councils, the early church at the time, as to whether Gentiles could be brought into faith and what restrictions they would put on them and how it was to be done. It was a new thinking that had to take hold, a new way of looking at the world and of life and of faith. The disciples had had 3 years of sort of apprenticeship with Jesus. They had watched him, they had listened to him, they had prayed with him, they had eaten with him, and they had come to believe that he was the one who could change their lives and was the Messiah for the world. This Ethiopian had what? A few minutes? An hour? How long it took him. But still he was baptized. And the early church had to come to terms with what preparation had to be made before people could be included in their ranks. And this was a difficult thing to do. What was necessary for faith? What was necessary for people to be baptized? And I think still we have the same conversations in our churches today. How do we respond to people whose background has not been in the church? We had a long apprenticeship. It would be nice to have a sort of survey. Most of us, I would suspect, went to Sunday school, would be taught religious studies in our national schools, were in youth groups like MAYC. Think of those days. We had an apprenticeship before taking on the responsibility of membership. That isn't the case today. There's so few of children. It's wonderful to see you have children growing up here and to welcome them and to support them. But there are many churches that I go to who don't have any children at all. And we think, how are they to learn? How are they to be brought out of all the temptations of the other things that can happen on Sundays and brought into a faith which might feel foreign to them? So the church of today is a very different place. But I go to that image that in our other reading of Jesus talking about the vine, of people being grafted into the vine, of the vine, as I was saying to the children, certainly seedless grapes, such as the ones we buy, wouldn't grow if you planted them. There are some that will grow, but they're hard to do. The way of propagating the vine is to graft it onto the branches. And here's Jesus, the very last moments before he was going to die, talking to the disciples about what was necessary in order to grow, was to be grafted and included and kept going in the vine. I think this is a critical moment for the church today. And our churches are reducing in numbers and influence and power. We are not consulted as we once were. The church throughout the country and throughout the world is finding different temptations and different things that are taking us away, and facing difficult questions about what we feel are essential things that we can't lose, or what might be changed and grow in a different way. Sorry, I'm losing my place. I hate reusing notes. We have a challenge to make faith relevant. The world is in turmoil, and how do we face the challenges of the world? I have great admiration for the Welsh poet R.S. Thomas. And in one of his poems, he writes this: "A congregation at prayer, telling God what he is like. You, who can do anything you please. You, who can replenish the empty belly of Asia. Continue this care, since never onto the platform of a star stepped a species more deserving." Is that the content of our prayer to God? And then he says, "Does God listen to them, crouched as he is over the interminable problem of how not to cheat when the hell-born spirit appears to be winning?" How not to cheat when the hell-born spirit appears to be winning. How do we maintain our loyalty to the faith in which perhaps we were born, perhaps which we have chosen, perhaps which is testing us at the moment, and we're wondering just where we're going with it all, what to believe in the all the different tensions that have come in our world? How do we relate to those whose faith has been different but real and strong and honest? And how do we gather the biggest picture we possibly can of the God who has made this world and us in it? And what do we feel about what we are being asked to do in the challenge of the age, of how we become loyal Christians who don't look always to the past, but can look to the future of what God is doing? How must we change? How must we adapt to the different tensions that are within our world, and the different possibilities that we can enter into for a God who is big enough to include in the church people who are not like us, people who have not had our traditions of the past, but who, for whom God is their essence, is the one who controls the world that he has made? And we're back to the vine. How do we incorporate in a one system of love and compassion and hope the things that that we perhaps don't appreciate fully, and where the gardener can graft in to all sorts of ways the people that we need to walk alongside and to be with? There are so many tensions in our world that we've got to be open to the possibilities that God is speaking to us through different ways, and not always comfortable ways. We hear him and we seek to follow him. I'm very fond of a comment by Dag Hammarskjöld. He said, "For the past, thanks. For the future, yes." Thanks be to God.